Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a food science writer, I'm a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today we're considering what foods we might be growing and eating in the year 2050. The global food system's evolved around a small number of plants and animals. 75% of our calories now come from just 5 animals and 12 crops. But as the world becomes more food insecure and the climate crisis worsens, the risk of relying on a small number of crops rises. And the risks aren't just around the crops, they're also around the geography of the system. We're seeing that now as the war in Ukraine causes global issues in food prices and supply. So the food system needs to adapt and change. We should be growing different crops in different places. Now, the good news is our world is full of incredible edible things, thousands of plants which can give us what we need, but which aren't currently being eaten at scale. Within that diversity, surely there are plants which could become new global or regional staples, which could resist drought, which could make us healthier. Well, I'm joined by a superb panel to find out what the diet of the future might be like and ask whether the food system is adaptable enough to get us there. With me are Richard Ellis, Professor of Crop Production at the University of Reading. He's an expert on seed and crop physiology and production. Hello there, Richard.
Hello.
Fantastic to have you. We've also got Dorothy Shaver, Global Sustainability Director at Unilever. She's also a registered dietitian and a friend of the podcast. She's been the focus of an episode about her career. Hello there, Dorothy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's fantastic to have you again. We've also got Dr. Maribel Soto Gomez, Research Fellow at Royal Botanic Gardens Kew and a researcher in plant evolution and agrobiodiversity. Hello there, Maribel.
Hi, Stefan.
Welcome to the podcast. So it's fantastic to have you all here. First of all, Richard, can we just tackle the reasons why we should think about change at all? The food system seems to be working relatively well. It got us just about, scraped us through a pandemic. Why might we need change to happen for the future?
Well, I think there's a very large number of people that would argue that the food system isn't working very well at the moment. If you look at the global picture, there's considerable malnutrition and indeed still hunger globally. There's also considerable environmental problems, and I'd emphasise that climate change isn't something in the future, it's affecting crop production now. And on top of this, there's considerable price inflation at the moment, as you've alluded to, with Russia's war on Ukraine. It's also fair to say that, a big issue out there is that, globally, farmers aren't a particularly happy bunch. Now, everybody can say, well, nothing new in that.
Never have been, but yes, but I get your point.
There are real pressures. There are real pressures on farmers as well in terms of finding the ability to find funds to actually invest in the future. I think if we jump to the future, the sort of the big concern all of my life has been the world population. When I was born, the world population was around about 2.5 billion. It's now close to 8 billion, and it's projected to rise to 10 billion by about 2060, depending on who's forecasting. We know that biodiversity is under considerable pressure from habitat loss, and that's not just wild species in terms of biodiversity, but it's also crop genetic diversity as well that's at risk. In other parts of the world, it's, what we've seen in Europe and North America, the continued drift from the countryside to the cities, especially of the young, and this is now happening big time in Africa, which means that all over the world, the population that's left to farm tends towards the more elderly. And then, as I said before, climate change is impacting on food production already, but of course we've also got the concern the other way around, how our food systems are themselves producing greenhouse gas emissions, not just methane from ruminants, which is the oft-quoted one, but e.g., from paddy rice as well. And of course, the cultivation of land for crops releases soil carbon all the time. So we've got big issues out there.
So I think you're absolutely right. So the thing that's the mantra, I would say now, is the population is going to be 9 billion 2050, but the specificity is immense, and the sustainability issues all the way down through various different subjects through to human health are becoming more and more critical. So Dorothy, what are the main threats to the global food system? So Richard's talked about climate change and a little about soil health. Where do you see it?
So there are a variety of different threats that we have right now. And unfortunately, we are in a food crisis. We are experiencing and will experiencing more price increases. Food insecurity is rapidly rising. There's a lack of fertilizer. There are climate disruptions, as Richard rightly mentioned. There's a low inventory of cooking oils and grains as a result of the conflict. There are major logistical bottlenecks in relation to imports and exports. And there are countries that are disproportionately affected, such as North Africa, Middle East, the Horn of Africa, West and Central Asia. Also, as already mentioned, food is a top contributor to species loss, climate change, pollution, malnutrition, and a key contributor to deadly diseases. I think if we flip that around, not to bring everybody terribly down, food does remain the strongest lever to optimize human health and environmental sustainability on Earth. That being said, the foods that we're eating and the way that we are growing them is harming our planet and taking far too much resource. And as was already mentioned, we eat the same foods repeatedly, which means we grow the same foods repeatedly, which is harming the planet while not providing sufficient nutrients. Also, the foods we eat are very resource intensive. The food system is a major contributor to climate change, understanding that it's responsible for approximately 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions, with 60% coming from animals. So I think there's a lot to be done in this space, and it's also really clear that we need to stop wasting our food. About a third of all world's food goes to waste. And that also contributes to global greenhouse gas emissions. If waste were actually a country, it would have been the third biggest carbon footprint after US and China. So there's a lot for us to do. I think there's major opportunities for us to turn this around, and it needs to happen quickly, and it needs to happen with efficiency in order for us to continue to feed the world nutritiously. And what needs to be done really is we need to grow the right foods in the right places, in the right ways and in the right amounts.
So I think both you and Richard are sort of talking about change that's required. But Mary Bell, this isn't a new issue, isn't it? The over reliance on specific crops and places has been a recurring theme throughout thousands of years of agricultural revolutions. You know, I mean, the potato famine was very much the same issue, wasn't it? The potato was planted as this wonder crop after the Columbian exchange, and it fed millions of people and supplied nutrition, and then we relied too much on one particular strain. When that failed, millions of people died in Ireland. I mean, obviously the English were complicit in that because we're running other parts of the world. But the message has been around for ages. So why haven't we been able to change our food sources in order to adapt?
I think this happens by chance in large part, in that the major crops that we rely on are actually great crops. So the three most important ones that provide 60% of our calorie intake are maize, wheat, and rice. And they're great crops. We like to eat them. They grow well in many different places. They're well adapted. And they've brought us this whole way, humanity. They were domesticated about 10,000 years ago, and they have allowed humanity populations to grow to the size that we are today. And so it's only really becoming a big issue now that we're seeing crises like the one in Ukraine and Russia. They're really showing just how important it is to diversify our food systems when we have so many people to sustain with nutritious food, and how severe food shocks can happen with some of these situations when one of our three major food staples are decreased in availability. So that's the case with wheat because of the conflict in Ukraine and in Russia. And so for many things in life, we're told that we shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket. And I would say that it's the same for food. We need to massively expand the range of foods that we eat so that we can have a steady food supply, even if there are foods that become suddenly not available. And as Professor Ellis already mentioned, and Dorothy, we need to take this very seriously because there's conflict, but there's also climate change that is already having its effects, but will continue to have more and more effects in terms of food shocks in the future. And I don't want to sound like it's all gloom and doom. I think that, as you mentioned in the introduction to the podcast, there's good news because there are over 7,000 edible plant species worldwide, and we're only currently exploring about 5% of those. And so there's still a huge diversity left for us to explore and make our food systems more resilient to future food shocks.
Now, before we explore some of those crops, I'm just interested in...
Could I just come in, Stefan? And just...
Yeah, please do, Richard.
Can I just add to what Mary Bell was saying? I mean, she's quite right to say that the major world crops are major world food crops because of their botanical and agronomic characteristics. But there's another thing in the food system that's really, really important in terms of looking at where change is going to come from and how it's going to occur and over what timescales, which is very simply that the major world food crops have turned out to be easily industrialized, if you like, easily mechanized on a big scale, and not merely the crop production easily mechanized, but the transport and distribution of those materials in enormous volumes now has also been easy to occur because the staple cereals are dried easily and at low moisture contents, they're relatively immune to damage from insects and diseases and have a good stability, as do potatoes in the right storage conditions over a long time as well. So there are reasons that go beyond the simply botanical. It's the integration of the botanical with the agronomy and with the actual food chain systems. And one of the big problems that agriculture faces in much of the world, it's not just Britain, is actually a shortage of labour at many times, particularly dealing with peaks at harvest and things like that, which is where mechanisation is vitally important to actually deliver cheap food to people in the cities.
Yeah. Now, I wondered if this is a question for all of you, really, but I'm concerned about why there isn't more of an anger amongst people. And is it because in the West we are relatively wealthy and that food shortages really affect the poor so much more than the wealthy, because the proportion of your usable income that's spent on food is relatively small the wealthier you are and enormous the poorer you are. So is that why there are not riots in the street in Europe? We hear about bread riots and things like that from the far past, but also in modern countries. Mexico's had corn riots, there have been bread riots, but is the lack of urgency here in the UK because people don't feel the pain quite as much?
Well, I think that the history tells us something about this. Is if you look at the last time that Britain suffered a major issue of food supply, this was during the Second World War. And the government was in front of that one, introducing food rationing, because there's a comment out there, which is that, if you've got money, you're never hungry. And actually, that's not always true, but it's very often true. And rationing was an excellent way of, if you like, sharing the pain. And if you talk about food, I mean, my mother and her generation used to talk about food far more in about the food quality of what they purchased, how much fat there was on it. There wasn't enough, and so on. Used to talk about that far more than the current generation in the UK does, even though it may be a lot still. So I think there are lessons from the past about why the attitude to these things in Britain, which is ultimately the government will sort it out, actually. Whereas you look at many of those countries in the world where there are riots, where they know, the people know, actually, the government has never sorted this out. Now, whether that would change with a different government in Britain that wasn't capable of sorting it out is another matter.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's delve into what those foods are. So the first of all, the foods that are making up the vast majority of the world's calories. Mary Bell, we've got 5 animals and 12 crops. Can you tell us a little bit about that group? You mentioned, 3 have been mentioned as the core ones, but there are several others as well. Let's talk about the animals too.
So my expertise are mostly in plants. If we focus on the plants, the majority of the main staples globally are cereals and root tubers. So as I mentioned before, these include maize, rice, wheat, but also other cereals like barley and sorghum. And if we think about roots and tubers, these include potatoes, sweet potatoes, which we consume widely in the West, but also things like cassava, which are a major source of nutrition in the tropics, and yams as well. We can also think about beans, which are an important source of protein worldwide, including for those who have vegetarian diets. And so, like we mentioned before, those crops provide about 90% of our source of calories. And then there's that 10% that we can also talk about. So where does that food come from? As you mentioned, there are, of course, animal sources to supplement that 90% of calories from plants. And it's a bit harder to pin down, I think, this diversity because it's a bit more fragmented. So what I mean by that is that there are about 400 other crops that the Food and Agriculture Organization records as being widely grown. Some are grown at a global scale and others are more regional, and these supplement the staple foods that we eat that provide major sources of calories. And these foods include things like fruits and vegetables and nuts and seed. And these are key sources of vitamins and minerals. But also part of that missing 10% are more localized foods. So these are locally adapted foods that do well in local environments and are also culturally appropriate. And of course, these foods go beyond plants. So they include things like meat, fish, milk, eggs, and insects, which might surprise some people, but insects are an excellent source of protein and already widely used in many countries around the world. But to bring it back to plants and maybe think a little bit about animals too, it's important to remember that these foods are not always grown as crops. So these more local foods are instead often collected from wild habitats. And that's a very important source of food that we need to protect because it can really help to buffer against seasonal shortages of crops or emergency shortages of crops, like the wheat shortage that we're seeing because of the war in Ukraine. And so by increasing the diversity of foods that we eat, we're by extension protecting all of biodiversity and the places, the wild places where that food can grow and sustain itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I just want to bring in Dorothy here because obviously Unilever is an enormous company. Now, I would have said that there are two points of view here for Unilever. On one level, a large company needs stable, enormous amounts of crops that it can understand how to process and how to put through its systems as easily as possible. But at the same time, if those sources are under threat from supply problems, then that can be absolutely disastrous for a company and can topple them over. What's Unilever's view on the immense importance or the lack of importance of diversity in the food chain?
Yeah, so I think just to go back on a couple of points, I think one of the reasons to go back on the importance of these three crops that were mentioned, the wheat, rice, and corn, in relation to that, they're also very diverse and versatile from a technical point of view. So they have many different uses from, you know, the use of creating them into a starch or into a thickener, or utilizing them in a lot of different formats when it comes to product creation. So I think it's also really important that almost from farm to fork, maybe, or from kind of seed to stomach, they are easily kind of grown and they're also easily put into a variety of different products. So I think that's also why we produce so much and why we consume so much. That being said, those three crops will have to shift and there will have to be much more diversification when it comes to crops and countries that we rely on as a result of climate crisis and conflict. So within the Unilever supply chain, we have a wide range of ingredients and we have been looking to further diversify that. As you would imagine, with the decrease in inventory in oils and in wheat, we've had to work out how to really diversify those different oils and to also avoid, of course, different technical problems, different problems from a spoilage perspective, and also from an allergy perspective. So this has been looked at for quite some time, even before we came into the conflict space with Ukraine and Russia causing these disruptions in the supply chain, to make sure that we do have a resilient supply chain. So there's two big areas for us to really look into. One is further diversification. So looking at how do we diversify different things like different types of starch away from cassava, which is one of those 12 crops, which is consumed quite a bit, or how do we further diversify when it comes to looking at different oil uses, and how do we become really creative in what we use? And in order to do that, we created a thought leadership piece in 2019 called Future 50 Foods, which is much more relevant now than ever. So it was created with NOR together with WWF actually as an inspiration from the exact stats that we're talking about, the 12 and 5 making up 75%, and of course the 3 making up a large majority of plant-based calories. And it's really about saying, from a thought leadership perspective, we absolutely need to diversify what we're growing and also what we're eating in order to improve the health of the planet and the health of people. So these 50 foods are created and chosen specifically based on their nutrient value, their land use, their resource use, their availability around the world, and also the ability of them to help open up supply chains, which will improve livelihoods. So this is done from a global perspective, and these foods are being utilized for us to look at how do we diversify the grains in our supply, how do we diversify the types of starches, what do we do when it comes to making sure that we have enough, you know, tomatoes, and onions, potatoes, and making sure that we do diversify. I think, you know, from the perspective of Unilever, it's up to us to make it easier to diversify what we eat by changing the ingredients in our products and by diversifying what we have in our products when it comes to ingredients. It's also really up to us to help consumers be inspired and enabled to eat a wider variety of foods. So that's what we're doing through the brands such as Knorr, which is Unilever's largest food brand, and also through Hellmann's, is inspiring people to use a variety of different ingredients, providing recipes, providing different swaps, to kind of change just one or two ingredients in their favorite dishes to enable a larger amount of diversity, which in turn will enable a lot more biodiversity in food and in agriculture. It's also really important that we look at the way food is grown. So the way food is grown is also severely important when it comes to its impact. So we've moved from looking at how do we sustain the land? How do we create programs that sustain the amount of water and keep it the same? How do we create programs that sustain the soil, to actually going further into regenerative agriculture principles to make sure that we are actually regenerating that land, making sure we're reusing resources and making sure that we're utilizing cover crops. But at the end of the day, we need to get people to change the way that they eat so that we can change the foods that are grown. Most things in the world when it comes to food are very much driven by demand, and that demand is delivered and chosen based on flavor. So we as a food industry and also as an influencer in the world of food, we have to move toward really getting the food that's the best for people in the planet, a diverse diet that's grown in regenerative ways, to be the coolest, most delicious, most affordable, most accessible food. And until we do that, we won't be able to shift the food system. So the transformation actually comes from a consumer's voice. So I think it's really important for us to collectively empower people to make small changes in order to really change the food system for the betterment of now and in the future.
That's comprehensively put. I'd say that there's a business imperative for diversity as well. Now, Richard, before we delve into the fun bit, which is looking at the specific crops, which I can't wait to get onto, I think we have to look at the concept of agricultural revolution. Now, ever since 12,000 years ago, when you know, we stopped hunter-gathering and began to plant and harvest, there have been changes in the way that we farm. And there's the Arab agricultural revolution, British agricultural revolution, the invention of the seed. Seed plough and the seed drill and all sorts of different elements, but there have been incremental elements to revolution, to the agricultural revolution every single year. Anyway, has every part of every agricultural revolution resulted in less biodiversity? Has there always been a culling of the crops as it's moved along, as we've developed?
Well, I suspect that culling, as you call it, is because of the relative advantages and disadvantages of certain production systems, rather than farmers deliberately saying on day one, we're not going to do this any longer. Mm-hmm. It becomes one of the, well, this is a little bit easier, I haven't got so much time. And there's a sort of a shift in that way, which is why I was mentioning mechanization earlier on.
Yeah, it goes hand in hand, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And it's right to say, I mean, some of the good things that have come from this, remember, is, you know, in terms of inventions, if that's the right word, the Norfolk Four Course Rotation, for example, was actually an improvement that in terms of crop biodiversity was actually a positive.
Okay.
In the sense that it wasn't continuous cropping, it was let's have a rotation. This is far more important for things and so on. So they don't all work that way. But I think there's a, in terms of this food debate, I mean, Dorothy's talked about, you know, the food processors and so on. I mean, for farmers, you know, commodity production is actually a bit of an economic problem because it becomes how cheaply can you produce it, as it were. The route out of that is for the sort of crops that people eat directly. And some of this is with the food processing industry. I mean, if you look at, the post-war period in Britain, at least, you know, one of the best innovations in my book is probably the frozen pea. This is a food supply chain that takes a fresh produce, high in vitamins, you know, really high food value, good for nutrition and so on, preserves it in a perfect condition, in a way that it can be stored, you know, long term, and used at will by the consumer in a remarkably brief time. You know, I think that's one example of the sorts of things that can work and also improve people's nutrition. I think in the developing world, there's similar technology, not so grand, that can be used. I mean, there's very simple food chillers, for example, that are developed that simply rely on the evaporation of water to provide the cooling, as it were. And it's amazing how these sorts of simple devices can extend food life by days, which is all you need, you know, in that sort of circumstance. You don't need it for months. You just need it for a couple of days. And that sort of technology can be immensely appropriate. I am conscious of the fact that I'm not really answering your question, however. I think you might need to remind me.
Well, it's just that I just wonder, have we just been shedding diversity since the birth of agriculture and because things have just got easier? And why the corollary of that is really, why now? Why now do we need to stop that and diversify?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it starts from the ending of foraging. Or the winding down of foraging. I mean, that's where it starts from, in terms of the limited biodiversity. But there's another big change that came in, not quite post-war, post-Second World War, slightly before, but particularly afterwards, which was the internationalisation of crops and foods. If you go back to the 1930s in Britain, most of the small agricultural merchants in a market town serviced their own area with the varieties that were largely local to that area and with the range of crops that were largely local to that area. Jump to now and you've got international companies supplying the same variety, not over every country in the world, but many countries of the world, and equally crops that have been deliberately selected. For example, soybean. There are, you know, latitudinal adaptations that have been selected for so that if you know where you are, above or below the equator, you know which group of soybean varieties to grow to meet the climate or the day length, essentially, in that region. So you've got this internationalisation going on. You've got the sort of the effects of the Green Revolution. I mean, the Green Revolution was fantastic. But what it did was it didn't start something, but it accelerated the loss of local varieties. And that's what crop gene banks seek to do worldwide, is to conserve that local material. Because plant breeding is the oddest of things in terms of its outcomes. Plant breeding is essentially a pyramid. You rely on a really wide genetic base to start with, and you go up that pyramid through the generations to pick the bit at the top, which is the really high-yielding crop variety. But the moment that crop variety is really successfully globally, you're at risk of losing the bottom of the pyramid. And of course, this is writ large when you start, as Mary Bell would say, you start to talk about crop wild relatives and so on. That if we don't take the long-term view and we take the short-term view all the time, we're actually undermining our own civilization.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Could I just add a little bit about genetic diversity, just to kind of riff off of what Professor Ellis is saying? And that for a long time, I think the message in plant science was that genetic diversity is decreasing. And I think that's the case in many crops, but the truth is that I think it's a major research gap that we still have to face. So genetic diversity in terms of land races, I think, has been shown to decrease. So land races are traditional varieties, and I think they are decreasing for many major crops, but we do have improved or modern varieties that were created at times during like the Green Revolution, for example. And so I think the message that I want to get across, and I don't know if Professor Ellis will agree, is that actually we don't know a lot about the genetic status and diversity of a lot of the crops that we eat and about the future crops that we hope to integrate into our food systems. And I think this is a major, majorly important area of plant research for the future.
Yeah, okay. I think you've all made your point that we need this. Right now, let's get into the fun bit. So the fun bit for me, I guess more complex for you. Right, what are the exciting crops that might point to the future, possibly whilst also pointing to the past as well? Mary Bell, can you start by choosing some of the exciting potential crops that we might be eating in 2050 or that we could eat in 2050?
Well, I could talk about this all day. It's going to be very hard to choose
you because I... Pick a couple, there's three of you.
I'll choose two. And the first one that I'll start with is the nopal cactus, which many people will already be familiar with because it's where the prickly pear fruit comes from.
Yeah.
But what might be less known is that in Mexico, where I'm from, we also eat the spiny green parts, so the cactus pats. And those are a very good source of vitamin A and C. They're very delicious. And the bonus is that there are about 1,500 species of cacti that are closely related to that prickly pear cactus that are also edible. So there's a huge source of diversity that we could tap into there.
Yeah.
I'm also a huge fan of legumes for reasons that might be obvious to some people already. So the legumes include foods like beans, lentils, and chickpeas that we already know and love because they're a relatively cheap and rich source of protein. They're very important in vegetarian diets, and they're also very good for soil health because they're able to bring in their own nitrogen, which is a major building block for plant growth and for human growth. And so if I think about legumes, I'm going to choose the lab-lab as an exciting future legume. It's a versatile plant that's already grown in many parts of dry or arid Africa because it's very drought tolerant. But right now it's mostly grown as fodder crop for livestock. And so the idea would be to enhance its use by humans. It's currently used by humans, but not as much. And so what's great about this plant is that most parts of it can be eaten, including the roots, the leaves, the flowers, the pods, and the beans themselves. One thing to remember, though, is that the beans are toxic when they're raw, and so these have to be cooked.
But that's the same for a lot of beans anyway, isn't it? We shouldn't be scared of that.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, I don't mean this as a scary thing about lab-lab. It's just one preparation method that we need to take into account. But I think it's a legume with a lot of potential for the future.
Fantastic. Okay. So you've chosen two. Well, you've chosen a whole group there. So I think that's cheating a little bit, but what the heck. Richard, can you tell us about some of the crops that you find very exciting at the moment?
Yeah, I think probably from a crop production point of view to the general audience, my bit's going to be really boring. The thing that I'd emphasise would be fruit and vegetables in general, and particularly in Africa, for example, the traditional African vegetables, of which there are very many, and as Mary Bell was saying before, very locale specific, you know, very local things as well. So I think I'd emphasise much more on that side. What I would say is that what's worried me a little bit about the coverage of the Ukraine war is all this emphasis on wheat, and particularly how it's affecting certain developing countries. And I can see why big organisations say we've got to find wheat from somewhere else and so on. But actually, you know, vegetables in warm countries with enough moisture, you can grow a vegetable from seed to harvest or first harvest in as little as 3 weeks. So actually, in terms of people where there's a problem now, if people want to, you know, provide a vegetable solution, you can start to provide that really quickly, about the same time as it takes to take a, you know, a bulk carrier from, South America to China. You can actually change systems quite quickly if you wanted to. And it's a mark of our society and the voices in our society that all the talk is about wheat, and wheat, as it were, from Ukraine. Mm. And, not what else could we do? Because there's many other things we could do globally.
But as you say, the mechanical processes are set up for wheat, aren't they? We're locked in by the whole production system.
And the vegetable solution, in the way I'm talking at least, would require a local solution. It would require many local solutions. But I do think that's the answer to many of our problems, actually, instead of painting a global brush. But I want to come back to something that Dorothy said absolutely correctly. It's about consumers and what do consumers want. You know, so people say to me, oh, I don't eat anywhere near as much chips as I used to, you know. But actually, look at the UK population. We're eating more chips, more crisps, more potatoes. Actually, we might be eating less mashed potatoes and so on. But we certainly aren't. We haven't stopped eating potatoes. The one thing I want to give is an example of where where a great idea of ours failed. In the 1990s, we decided to put a lot of energy and time into improving lentil production in the UK for the human food market for the UK. And to cut a long story short, the big problem was always the quality of the crop at harvest, you know, whether it was good enough for humans or whether you could only, you know, anyway, we solved it quite simply. And we then tried to persuade producers to take it on. We actually, you know, we took it out to companies and the National Farmers Union. We took it out beyond that point. But one of the things that really became clear at that time, this is 25 years ago, by the way, is that we realised that 6,000 hectares in the UK would probably do the job. And so for it to become bigger and for it to be worth farmers in the UK really getting really, really interested in it, we'd have to pursue an awful lot of consumers to buy lentil an awful lot of the time. And I think this is where you get into the, you know, chicken and egg situation between producers and consumers with the food processors well and truly in the middle of that chain. So I'm actually, I'm not convinced that we will get, I think our changes by 2050 will be incremental and slow.
Yeah.
I'd like to see them particularly focusing on malnutrition and in particular, which is a bigger problem globally than hunger, but hunger's the worst of all, of course. And I see that through more diversity of foodstuffs, absolutely, definitely. But you know, it's easy to become pessimistic on things that's so difficult for individuals to alter.
Although I would chip in and say we're now growing quinoa in I think it's Kent is the British quinoa coming from, which may not be the best place to grow it, but at least we're doing it and we're diversifying teeny tiny little bit.
Not surprising at all. 2,000 years ago, we grew another Chenopodium species as a crop, and it's now one of our major weeds, fat hen.
So it's possible. That's all we're saying. Okay.
So yeah, and in fact, there's very many crops that can be grown here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Dorothy, now Unilever is the company that's going to have to buy and process, market, deal with suppliers, change factories. So what are the crops, the future crops, that Unilever and you are most excited about?
Okay, so we have Future 50 Foods, and that's absolutely the thought leadership piece that we will take from as we move forward to diversify. And in there, you'll find a variety of different grains, beans, nuts, seeds, leafy green vegetables, cactus, algae. And the intention of it is to do exactly what we're talking about. And I'm going to point out a couple that are my favorites that I hope that we move further into. And they're part of food groups, so I'll go into that. But I think what we actually need to do collectively is create some criteria of the types of foods that we do move toward and create the criteria on how they're grown. Because as you rightly said, we have quinoa growing in Kent, we have teff growing in the Netherlands. And unfortunately, to create those environments takes a lot of resource, a lot of people, and actually is stripping an opportunity from the places where those foods are originally grown. So there's a lot to be done when it comes to creating that criteria and creating kind of the global space when it comes to what do we grow where, when do we go local, when do we go global, as Richard rightly mentioned. So that being said, we have to be growing foods that don't require water in places that don't have water, because we know that some experts say we have less than 30 years left of water, and we know that food is the number one user of water. So I'm going to use one example of a grain that I absolutely love, which is called fonio, which is grown in a variety of different warm places across Africa. It's a drought-resistant crop. It can actually grow in sandy and acidic oil, and we know that soil is becoming more and more acidic with time and becoming more like sand. We also know that the roots of fonio secure topsoil and prevent it from spreading into deserts, and it's also one of the fastest growing crops. It's also called the lazy farmer's crop because it's so easy to grow, you can just simply scatter the seeds around and it grows by itself. Also, it's really important to understand that it's super duper nutritious, it's really versatile, and really easy to cook. It's also gluten-free, so it's high in iron, zinc, magnesium, and phytonutrients, and it can be substituted for a variety of different grains such as couscous and potentially, of course, quinoa and other things. It's also versatile in that it can be made into different types of pastas. So instead of just regular wheat, it can potentially be used as fonio. So that's one of my favorites. The other favorites that I'd like to bring up is Bambara groundnuts. They have an incredible nutrient profile, and they're one of the few foods in the world that actually has fat, protein, carbohydrates, and fiber, and also many, many vitamins and minerals. They have a little bit less fat than peanuts, and they actually taste like peanuts. I had the opportunity to try them, and they also have amazing qualities when it comes to the environmental perspective. They have a variety of different ways to actually naturally nourish the soil, as was mentioned earlier, when it comes to a variety of different types of beans or ground nuts. They're grown in regions of sub-Saharan Africa, and they also can be grown in a variety of different places. They're also known to really help secure the soil, so decreasing soil erosion and further helping the plants around them. So those are two of my many favorites. I think the other ones that I'd like to just mention as a group is leafy green vegetables. By nature, they are by far the most nutrient dense, so they have the most nutrients per calorie. And as Richard said, they're very fast growing. They can be grown in a variety of places around the world, and they should be grown and eaten far more. The other area I'd like to say is our need to eat cover crops. So there are a variety of different foods that can be utilized as cover crops. Some of them are grains, some of them are leafy green vegetables, some types of root vegetables, and also lots of beans. And they're used now to naturally nourish the soil between harvests, and they're often wasted or just kind of ground into the soil to keep the soil really healthy. But it would be really fantastic if we started to love those cover crops and to love those types of foods that are grown in that way and utilized to naturally nourish the soil between harvests, because it would not only provide an extra income for the farmers, but it would also provide a huge amount of increase in supply of really nutritious foods in most cases. So I could go on this for days, as I'm sure others could as well, but I think those are the few areas that I would say, in addition to the ones that were already mentioned, that I'd like for us to move into.
Yeah. But the key element for this, for change, is the market. So consumers, and I wondered from your point of view, Dorothy, how adaptable are they? What do they need to be able to tempt them to eat new and relatively unusual crops? They need an upside. Is it going to be price? Is it nutritional value? Sustainability issues? You know, buying to save the planet? What's the thing that's going to help change? Because change is hard, isn't it?
Change is extremely hard, and we've worked a lot in the space of behavior change, and I've personally done quite a bit of work in the space of dietary behavior change, and it's really about helping people make little teeny changes that they're comfortable with. So when we say everybody needs to stop eating meat and move to all beans and all plants, one, it isn't the right thing to do from an environmental perspective, but two, it's not realistic from a behavior change perspective. So what we need to do as an industry is inspire people to make simple changes, such as adding leafy green vegetables to a stew, such as changing out half of the beef and putting in beans, trying a different color tomato, trying a different color cabbage, and making those different changes. So really saying you can still have your cabbage stew, try a purple one instead. It will add more color, adds more nutrients, and it also helps contribute to biodiversity and also, of course, dietary diversity. So those simple changes are absolutely needed. We need to make it really, really easy to make these changes. We need to make it accessible, so it needs to be in the face of shoppers. It needs to be in the restaurants to be inspired. So the first place people usually make change on the plate is actually in a restaurant, in a canteen, out of the home, because there's less risk, and it's usually you individually eating that food and not a whole group of people eating the same. So that's a big space that we need to start to inspire behavior change. In the retailer, in the grocery store, We need to put those foods that are better for us and better for the planet right at the beginning. We need to have pop-ups to say, hey, why don't you try a different type of grain, a different type of this, and make sure that the price is exactly the same. So that we're inspiring by different triggers at different times, because it's hard to know what people are looking for. But the one thing we know, well, I'd say two big things that we know, is that the food choices are driven by flavor and acceptability across the board, across the world. Of course, there are other elements that come into play at different times. And unfortunately, we are entering a dire time that price will move to the top of that priority list. But flavor is first. So what we need to do as a food industry, as chefs, as retailers, is really make sure that that desirability is at the front of the line every time. We also need to utilize these people that have huge influence, the Beyoncés of the world, the Jamie Olivers of the world. We need to utilize these people that are influencers and inspirers, the Kardashians, for example. We need to utilize their voices and their reach to make these foods super, super cool, inspirational, and what people want to eat, because otherwise we won't be able to make those changes.
Yeah. Okay, Mary Bell, a sort of similar question for you, really, to as we're drawing this to a close. You know, it's all very well coming up with exciting crops that make your heart race, but how do you use those to achieve change, but also get funding for more food research so you can carry on finding new sources?
That's a very good question. And I arrived in the UK relatively recently, and I've been happy to see, at least at my institution, at Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, there's a huge push to focus on food research. So if we think about our science strategy for the next few years, it largely centers on the sustainable future of food and improving farming methods and working with our collaborators all around the world to find these foods that we might be eating in the future. And I think that it's not a very difficult sell currently to funders. I think that increasingly so, people are aware that we need to future-proof our food systems. In my experience in the UK, funders are putting money towards this.
Just to follow up on that, really, Maribel, is it's you've done really well, I think, at getting these in the press, these issues. But it's these things, a bit like in eating, insect eating and things like that, starts as a gimmick. How do you push this through to make it a reality? What do you need, do you think, to actually achieve change?
Research is a fundamental part of it. So identifying and conserving the crops that we want to be eating. And also what Dorothy already discussed, inspiring people to uptake these foods. And so one effort to do that I'm very familiar with, because I'm working at Kew, is a festival that we're organizing that's called Food Forever. So it's a summer festival that brings in together scientists, chefs, and artists, and the general public, of course, to start a conversation about food and to have people reflect on how powerful and transformative their food choices can be. And of course, rooted in delicious food and celebration around that. And I think that one key thing to remember when we're thinking about globalized food systems and bringing into our food system crops that we are not yet growing, it's to think about access and benefit sharing. So there's a lot of know-how associated with how a crop is grown, and a lot of history. And that's developed over centuries or even millennia. And so we need to respect these mechanisms and protect the interests of the people that domesticated these crops, that have been growing them for a long time, and rely on these crops and have a lot of traditional knowledge around that. So I think that if we keep those different pieces in mind, science, respecting the origin of the crop, growing it in a sustainable way, and then inspiring people to uptake these new foods, I think that we're on a good path to improving the resilience of our food systems.
Fantastic. Okay, which brings us to Richard. The final comment from you then. How do we bring diversity, the dream of diversity, into reality? Because humans, we don't change easily, do we? Is it excitement? Is it PR and marketing, political and business will? What's the thing that will push this into reality?
Well, in terms of the last point you made, I would say it's multidisciplinary. It requires a range of expertise across many different fields. And I'll just pick up on something Dorothy said about making certain foodstuffs more fashionable and so on, and how you influence this behavioural science aspect. It's well known that children aren't very good with vegetables. Young children aren't very good with vegetables. But there have been quite a lot of behavioural science studies that have looked at tricks. I mean, one used at the University of Reading was for mothers and fathers to read from picture books to children about the story of certain vegetables, and then to introduce that vegetable at the meal table. And these things don't have massive effects overnight, but they're a good example of the sort of incremental activity that's required long term to change the food demand by the next generation, as it were. Because when we're talking about 2050, it's too late for me. It's the next generation we're talking about. So what very young children do, what teenagers do now, how their diets might be, they might be persuaded to change their diets and improve their health and nutrition through that route, is vital to, I think, what you see for food demand come 2050.
Well, that has all been massively, well, exciting and entertaining and hugely informative. So Richard Ellis, Dorothy Shaver and Maribel Soto Gomez, thank you all so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, we've got hundreds more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, you can find our series shining a light on sustainability roles in the food and drink sector, including Dorothy's episode. Just go to the site and search Green Jobs. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.